To our great shame and humiliation, the American government shut down barrels through day 37 with no end in sight, coming on the heels of the big blue wave that happened in the number of states in the Democratic areas on Tuesday. And now everybody's already looking forward to, first of all, how is all of this blue wave going to affect the shutdown? Is it going to make it more likely to be over? Is it going to push it back further? And then with the other eye, everybody's looking to the 2026 midterm. This election that we just had here was kind of like the tick point to say, all right, now that was the end of the previous election cycle. Now it's on to the next one. And what's that going to do? And so the race has begun. We're going to try to peel back what all this means. And we're very pleased to have today Jim Webb, a defense and policy consultant, somebody who's got a lot of experience working for campaigns and really is kind of plugged into what's going on in the electoral world and can kind of help us peel back between a lot of statements people make and what's actually going on the ground, which is where we like to live. Jim, as always, welcome to the show.
Hey, Dan, great to see you again. Happy to be here. And this is a pretty complicated subject. I'm not a soothsayer. I'm just going to give my best take on it and try and access with some data.
Wait, I'm sorry. I thought you were a soothsayer. I thought that's dumb. So now I don't know what we're going to do. I was expecting perfection and you're seeing into the future, but I guess we'll take whatever we can get.
1800 Wednesday, it'll be
over. It's so easy to soothsay in American politics. I mean, who could possibly have missed something coming up right now? So listen, let's jump right into it. As I said at the beginning of this, the U.S. government shutdown continues to cause pain for everybody except the politicians, who seem to be thinking that it's okay for everybody else to have suffered, and that's part of our problem, I think. But as we're going to discuss, I think there is some pain going on, or could be going on for them too. But first, we're going to talk about the pain that is going on. Trump administration announced that they will reduce traffic at 40 airports across the U.S. starting tomorrow if the shutdown continues. The transportation secretary said, "Hey, look, and we got to do what we got to do because you know our TSA folks are having to work without pay. A lot of them are calling in sick. A lot of them are unable to do it. They're the crazy thing about that. I don't know if you knew this, but a lot of them it turns out they like to eat, and when not getting paid for anything and not being able to pay their car payment, their house payment." Yeah. Or whatever, energy bills, et cetera, it's starting to be a real problem on them. But now that it's starting to cause a problem beyond just the government workers, now then they're actually going to have to cut down. As far as you know, has anything like this ever happened in previous shutdowns where we actually had to curtail traffic at airports?
Not that I've been able to pull up, Dan. This has gotten really, really out of hand and really fast. When you start talking about shutting down airports, you know, it's not just air travel. It is a major economic artery in this country. You know, it's how your mail gets across the country. It's how people take vacations. Obviously, it's how business operates. I travel a ton. I'm always in airports. It's already kind of a pain due to the old infrastructure to try to get around. But I can't imagine what this is going to do going right into the Thanksgiving holiday.
Well, yeah, that's what I was going to say. I mean, just in any ordinary time, it's going to be a real problem for the very reason you just mentioned. But, you know, we got this vector coming up, which before, let's say as of Monday, I'm not the expert that you are. I kind of expected that a lot of the elections would kind of be a toss up. We knew some big one, like Mendonca, because he had too big of an lead. But I figured it'd be some pros and cons and it would be an issue, but then they'd kind of move past it. But because of what happens, I think it's actually made it less likely that we're going to get to an end. Because I thought that the vector coming up with Thanksgiving and the air traffic and the TSA and the government's the people that are not working, I thought that was going to push everybody to finally say, okay, we'll get something off the table. How do you see it now?
Well, I tend to agree with you, Dan. I don't see, particularly coming out of the elections this week, that there's really any impetus for the Democrats to give an inch. The best way to kind of accent this is really get into the data. What is causing this, right? It's basically a $30 billion subsidy. And that is no small chunk of change.
In fact, before you get into that, if you could kind of boil it down to our viewers, if you can, because it seems to me that at least from the Democrat, that this all comes down to the ACA subsidies.
Correct.
Because the Democrats say, we want that negotiated before we will agree to sign on to an extension of the government. And then the Democrat and Republicans are saying, yeah, don't even worry about that. Just give me a clean CR. Is it really that simple?
I would like to think it is, but it's not. If you recall about a decade ago, or really 2017, there was a large push to get the ACA to effectively collapse under its own weight. And that appears to be kind of the, like, it's not stated, but it appears to be the angle which Republicans are doing it or going after right now. The ironic thing is with this subsidy, and once again, $30 billion wouldn't make a dent in the DOD budget or DOW budget, however you want to say it now. But that subsidy goes to basically what you can amount as Trump's voters. And I personally, I don't like the ACA. I didn't want it to pass when it did. But the reality is it's out there now and you got to deal with it. And a lot of people depend on it. And you're talking 40 to 50 million people who are, you know, they receive this subsidy. And who are these people? They're typically small business owners. They're typical entrepreneurs. They are, you know, they're people who are upper, lower income or middle income who really rely on this to keep their healthcare costs down because they either work for themselves or they work for a small business that doesn't provide them with healthcare. And if you take a look at how these folks voted in the last election cycle, you're talking 57% of them voted for Trump. Only 32% voted for Harris. They are 47% Republican. Oh, wow. They're 30% independent. 30% independent. It's that middle that everybody fights for in every election cycle. And they're the ones who are going to have to bear the brunt of this in a few months. Because if they don't pass these subsidies, your average premium, according to Kaiser, is going to go from about $890 to over $1,900
per month.
Yeah. And you're talking about an income bracket that's making, you know, 60K at most. It's about 45 to 60K. That's a ton of money.
Wow. Yeah, it's a huge percentage of your income.
Yeah. And demographically, these are the people who put Trump in office. And, you know, what's kind of interesting about the blue wave, and you can talk about the rhetorical approach to it last time, when we get to it, pardon me. But the interesting thing is this is like a little bit of political judo, which the Democrats have seemed to have like run. They have effectively captured these people, and they're used as pawns by both sides. I gotta be very clear. I don't think that's right to any stretch. But now they're defending them. Now they're in a position where they are defending the same people who put Trump in office over a $30 billion subsidy, to which there's no real clear explanation from the administration as to why they want to get rid of it. Like, what's your impetus here? Is it strictly cost savings? You can find $30 billion in a lot of places. And this is spiraled out of control. I live in a dark red district in Florida outside of Hurlburt Field. Used to be Matt Gaetz's district. And we have food banks set up throughout my neighborhood. You know, wow. Trailers where those of us who don't rely on a check from the government because we're not GS or military anymore are dropping stuff off for people. And this has real long-term implications because – you know, I don't think it's my opinion, just my opinion or my opinion anymore, that it really sends a message that the quote unquote leadership in this country, and that would be the administration, they are in charge. They have both houses and the executive branch. They also have a Supreme Court that's on their side. You know, they are the people to which the buck stops, you know, and they're not doing what they need to do to take care of the American people, generally speaking. And sure as heck aren't taking care of the voters who put them in office.
And let's get into a little bit of that as best you can ascertain. What is the motivation? We're going to look at both sides of this, but what is the motivation for the Republican side to continue on with this shutdown? Because it's pretty evident that this was an intentional situation. They knew exactly what would happen. Right. They knew what the Democrats were going to say on this because they've been talking about it for quite a long time. And the way they have responded over the now 37 days is like, yeah, not my problem. It's all your fault, and we're not going to do anything. And Mike Johnson, for example, keeps saying over and over how, you know, there's nothing to negotiate. We just want the clean CR, as though that's the only path to getting the shutdown done. And since the Democrats won't do it and five come across the aisle, then they won't do it. what is the, again, as best you can ascertain, what is the motivation for the Republican Party? What do they want to get out of this?
That's a great question, Dan, because I think this is pretty nonsensical across the board. I'm a limited government guy. I would prefer if the federal government, you know, was strictly adherent to the Constitution. We had a Navy and basically no standing army, and all we did was protect commerce and stay the heck out of everybody's life. That would be a dream to me. However, we have the largest government in the history of man right now. And the way that you want, or the way you may want to reduce it, but the way to actually cut it down to size is to use the system to do it. You have to legislate your way through this. You have to cut the agencies. You have to show leadership and say, hey, here is my objective. Here is what I want to see happen. Go get it. This seems to me at best a very passive aggressive way to get what they want, which is ultimately when you look at, like, say, DOGE, for example. You know, they wanted to cut the size of federal government. They did some bits and pieces with DOGE. Well, what are they doing now with the government shut down? They're reducing spending. They're riffing people. They're cutting them from the team, so to speak. But it's not a very above board methodology of doing it. And it's once again, lacks leadership. And I think that's their angle. I think they're trying to get the things that they wanted to get done through DOGE, but don't have the cojones, if you will, on the legislative side, in the House and the Senate, to actually put up there, because it would anger their constituents and risk their seats.
Yeah, but see, I've heard that, and some have speculated that. How right. do you get there? I mean, number one, DOGE was in place. They had it. They could have done a lot more. They stopped moving it. So how does the shutdown help them get to what it done before? And by the way, we're 37 days in, and only a couple of little riffs have been done, and nothing since. So even with right. that, I don't see what the plan is.
Yeah, and flatly, like, once again, not a soothsayer. I don't see a coherent plan, and this follows a line, you know, throughout the entire administration so far. It's been, you know, it feels like it's been a decade since
right. Trump came. Hasn't even been a year yet, right?
Yeah. With all the different bits and pieces and the chaos and the moving parts, and, you know, every day you wake up and you're about to kick off a war with a new country, you know, and it's hard to track. But the one common theme is there doesn't seem to be a plan, and there doesn't seem to be any real leadership in place to, you know, to move the ball towards a common objective or an objective that they've laid out to begin with. And to go back to the riffs, you know, it may be their plan to use, you know, to use this shutdown to riff people out. But at the same time, you know, the personnel side of the federal government is not the biggest expenditure. You know, and if you're going to target different agencies, there's plenty of fat that can be cut. But once again, you have to have, you know, people with their eye on the ball saying, okay, right. you know, this bulk of administrators over in agency Y, like, we don't need that. What the shutdown has done is it's impacted, you know, agencies that that need to function, that need professionals. And quite frankly, what you're doing and what has been going on, I've watched from my position, is a lot of talent is just leaving. It's not the people you want to have go. It's people right. who have dedicated.
That.
Yeah. It's people who have dedicated their career to, you know, advancing the lethality of the military, for one. It's people who have dedicated their careers in law enforcement, you know, different
medical
different
research. You can add that one in there too.
Yeah. You know, they can make a lot of money on the outside, but they've chosen to stay in as actually a public service. And, you know, those are the ones that are, they're now going to leave. And the people who you don't want to have there, the people who just, you know, who are your stereotypical type of, you know, I hate to say, like, lazy GS, they do exist. You know, they're the ones who are going to cling on and hang on for the long term, and you're going to accomplish nothing except weaken, you know, your own system.
Yeah, I mean, I literally see it playing out that way. Being in town here, I've got access to a lot of folks like that. Let's move on to what President Trump may be saying, because in the aftermath of both the blue wave and now the starting to be negative reaction on the government shutdown, especially among some of his core supporters, as you mentioned at the outset here, he has a rather unique recommended solution, shall we say.
It's time for Republicans to do what they have to do, and that's terminate the filibuster. It's the only way you can do it. And if you don't terminate the filibuster, you'll be in bad shape. We won't pass any legislation. There'll be no legislation passed for 3 1/4. We have 3 1/4 years, so that's a long time. But when they can't do an extension, and John, I think they've done an extension every single time they've ever been asked forever. This is the first time they haven't done an extension. Extensions are supposed to be easy, but if they won't do an extension, they won't do any bill, even a simple bill. And we should do our own bills. We should get out. We should do our own bills. We should open up. We should start tonight with the country's open. Congratulations. Then we should pass voter ID. We should pass no mail-in voting. We should pass all the things that we want to pass, make our elections secure and safe, because California is a disaster.
All right, let's take a few of those things in order there. First of all, I said, listen, the only way to get this done is to what's some call the nuclear option, which is to get rid of the filibuster. For those who may not know, what is the significance of that, and why haven't the Republican House, Senate done that yet?
So the filibuster keeps the Senate from turning into the House. You have a 60-vote you have a 60-vote threshold, which requires people to work together to come up with, you know, a plan everybody is on board with. You know, and that's the function of the Senate, is to slow everything down. You can write whatever you want on the House side as a congressman, and it'll go to the floor. Odds are it'll get passed, probably on a party line vote these days, but it'll never see the light of day in the Senate because people understand there's not consensus for it. And that's not how our country was designed. Our country was not designed to just pass laws willy-nilly. Before I go on, I would just like to thank President Harris up there for proposing to eliminate the filibuster, because this was a major, major campaign issue going into the last election cycle. If you go back to some of the rhetoric that was going around on that, myself included, I was freaked out by potentially President Harris getting into office and eliminating all barriers to, you know, that kind of agenda setting. Like you would literally have a one party government at that point. Whoever's in charge could get whatever they wanted done. Trump definitely registered on that. He was very adamant that this was a horrible idea, and they beat a lot of pavement on that issue. And it's really surprising to see him, you know, out there right now, you know, taking, you know, candidate Harris's line on this.
So it looks like he's just saying, hey, I just want a near-term win right now. We'll figure out the rest of it later. Yeah. So I don't have to, because it looks to me like, tell me if you disagree, it looks like he's saying, I don't want to compromise with anybody on anything. Mm-hmm. I just want this to go through. So at least for the next 12 months until a new House gets elected, where he may lose it, but he wants to just back have a clean sweep. How do you see it?
I think you're spot on, but it's very short-sighted, you know, and this is a very common theme with this president, unfortunately. You know, he's very focused on the deal. He wants a deal. He wants something done now. If you look at his, and then you're very familiar with this, I know, with the deal with Russia. He just wants a deal with Russia. And he's willing to do whatever it takes in the immediate term to get that deal. He's not thinking strategically long term, you know, for the betterment of the country. And he eventually is going to not be president at some point. And the other side is going to take over. And if you get rid of the filibuster, you know, the ability for the opposing party in the minority to slow down and destroy legislation, if need be, then you effectively have, you know, it's a rubber stamp. It's no different than executive orders going back and forth. You'll have one party come in, you know, for 4 years, do a whole bunch of stuff that will take the country off in a real wild trajectory. And then the next administration will come in and do the opposite. And it will just create absolute chaos within not only our system of government, but our system of laws. And we can't have
that. Great point. That's a great point. So that's something that we should avoid very much, but that's what he wants. But that's not all Trump wants, because he's also saying, hey, you know what would be cool? How's about we get Texas to give me 5 seats because I deserve them? We're entitled to them. And so here's several other states that I got. So he's like, yeah. And apparently Governor Abbott is like, 2 thumbs up. We're going to give you that. Well, what a surprise. Turns out that California and other Democratic states are not excited about that. That was one of the other part of the blue wave yesterday with this Prop 50, where now Governor Newsom has the capacity to do that. And here's how he put how they're doing it and why they're doing it now.
He doesn't play by a different set of rules. He doesn't believe in the rules. And as a consequence, we need to disabuse ourselves of the way things have been done. It's not good enough to just hold hands, have a candlelight vigil, and talk about the way the world should be. We have got to recognize the cards that have been dealt. And we have got to meet fire with fire. And we've got to be held to a higher level of accountability. So that's what this is about. It's not complicated. We're doing this in reaction to a president of the United States that called a sitting governor of the state of Texas and said, find me five seats. We're doing it in reaction to that act. We're doing it mindful of our higher angels and better angels. We're doing it mindful that we want to model better behavior as we've been doing for 15 years in the state of California with our independent redistricting commission. But we cannot unilaterally disarm. We can't stand back and watch this democracy disappear. We can't stand back and watch this democracy disappear district by district all across this country, not just in Texas, but in Missouri, where J.D. Vance went just a week ago, in Indiana, in places like Ohio, in places like Florida. We need to stand up.
Now, I'll tell you, I am categorically against what Texas is doing, because in my view, this disenfranchises people who live in those five districts and saying, if you're a Democrat, you don't need to go to the polls because your vote won't count anyway. Mm-hmm. But I am even more against this one, because, and this is what I like your view on, because to me, fighting fire with fire is the wrong. We need to fight fire with a fire hose to put the fire out. Mm-hmm. The last thing we need to do is have more fire, because then more things are going to get consumed in there. And I worry that now then California is looking to disenfranchise all the Republicans that may live in the districts that they're going to redraw. And they're saying that their votes don't count. Now, I'm going to get to the Republican reaction to this in just a second. Mm-hmm. But let's look at those two things here. How do you see the issue of both in Texas and California, and what Newsom's doing in response?
So I'll start off with I lived in a extremely gerrymandered district in Maryland. I lived for about a decade in Baltimore, and they drew our district in a way that made voting completely pointless. And it does two things. It creates apathy. It creates multiple things. Apathy, dysfunction, because you never have, you know, a marketplace of opportunity, if you will. There are no competing ideas. There is only one person in charge. And when you're talking about, you know, what they're going to do in California and Texas by disenfranchising large amounts of voters, like, okay, like you'll have the people who are able to vote with their feet will vote with their feet. That's still the wrong answer, but the large amount of people cannot do that. And if you're telling them that they have no voice and no ability to participate in the democratic process, which, mind you, is designed to prevent violence, particularly political violence, you know, then what happens next? It's a real dangerous slope to go down. One thing I will pull out of what he said before we get back into this is I really don't understand what he was saying about Missouri. I ran a U.S. Senate campaign there, and man, that state's blood red. Except outside of St. Louis, you could not gerrymander it to be any more Republican than it actually is. But that's kind of besides the point. But no, this is the president calling down and asking for five more votes out of Texas is categorically wrong. And what Newsom is doing is highly opportunistic. I truly don't understand how that man gets elected in California. He's like literally a shapeshifter. You put him in front of different audiences, he's a different guy. He has a hard time with the truth. He comes off as slick and greasy. But at the same time, what Trump is doing and what always happens in these kinds of scenarios is he is empowering Newsom to have a logical sounding voice.
Yeah.
And that does not need to happen, because, you know, if the one thing that was propping the Republican Party up going into the next presidential election cycle was the fact that the Democrats have absolutely no bench at the executive level or the presidential level. There's no one there. But you're giving this guy a fantastic issue set to get out there and sound, you know, like he is just and fighting for the people. And in a sense, like, you could make an argument that he actually is, because he's countering what is obviously wrong and coming down. But it doesn't make it right.
And let me ask you that, because some folks that I have queried and talked to about this say, well, he does kind of have a point, because if they've been trying, this is one of my Democratic friends, they say, because if part of the problem with the Democrats is they've been too weak-kneed, and they don't fight, they don't do anything. And so they've been following the rules, and then the rules are going to, Trump is blowing the rules off. So he's got to do this or it's not going to work. Is that true? Is it that the only thing that the Democrats have is to break the rules or rewrite the rules in a different way that disenfranchises somebody? Or is there another path? What else could they do?
Well, I think it's important to point out that, you know, I sort of mentioned this a second ago, but they are giving the Democrats the opportunity to play dirty. Strictly speaking here, you know, it's he is handing Newsom and other governors around the state exactly what they want. You know, when you're talking about, you know, when you get out there and say, hey, gerrymandering is bad, we don't do that, we're against that. President Trump could have said very easily, we want to redistrict, but we're going to do it in a neutral sense. Like, we're just going to draw little squares all across, you know, according to population, and let the chips fall where they may. But by presenting it as, you know, in effect, a favor to him to provide him, you know, extra clout in the House, you know, they are allowing governors across the country on the Democratic side to ensure that their party stays in power indefinitely. You know, you could very well, you know, it's you could change what your platform is if you're the Democrats. You could change your platform, you know, if you're the Republicans, and appeal to more voters, show some leadership. That would be the way to get votes, like
show some leadership.
That's the American way. But it's incentivizing not doing it. And it's really kind of tragic.
I want to, Gary, I'm going to skip the next one we had there about the GOP has predictably filed a lawsuit against this. They say it's unconstitutional, whatever, in California. But apparently it's cool in Texas. So we'll see how that's going to work out there. We'll see how either one of them are going to work out, but that's where they're headed at the moment. I want to kind of come back to both the combination of where the shutdown is right now and how yesterday is affecting the two political parties and where this may be headed in 2026. Here was Mike Johnson. I think it was earlier this morning, talking about the shutdown and saying how it's all the Democrats' fault.
The Democrats have painted themselves into a corner, Joe, as we've discussed before, because this really was, as some people say, the Seinfeld shutdown. It's a shutdown about nothing. There was no fight. There was no skirmish between the parties. When we passed back on September 19th, the Clean Continuing Resolution, it was nonpartisan. You know, it's 24 pages in length, bare bones, just to keep the lights on. And this is an important point. The whole reason for that is because the Republicans and the Democrats, who were appropriators, got together and said, we're running out of time to do the normal process, the regular order of funding the government. We need about 7 more weeks. So let's just extend it to November 21, and we'll all get our work done. That was the agreement they made, bipartisan and bicameral. But then Chuck Schumer decided to throw a big wrench in the middle of the machine, because he wanted to show a fight against President Trump because he needs political cover against the rising radicals in his party. I mean, that's pure and simple what this is about.
Is it pure and simple? That's what it was about from the Democratic side?
Not at all, Dan. I'll go back I'll give Mike Johnson I'll throw him one little bone at the end of that. He is right about what Schumer was doing, but it ties into the longer term political judo, which the Dems have been playing. If you look at their messaging in all of these different races, you know, we had Bidenflation during the last election cycle, during the presidential cycle. The Dems turned that into, the unaffordability crisis. You know, and where they're positioning themselves continuously is kind of trifold. One is they're on the side of the people and bringing costs down. A key piece of this is the expiring subsidies. Had the Republicans agreed to extend those subsidies, wouldn't have been an issue at all, would have gone away. Nobody would have cared. Now you walk up into these most recent elections, with that in mind, look at Mondami in New York. He ran a very local campaign, very local. Don't like the guy. I mean, I don't know him personally, so I can't say I don't like him. I don't like his policies. Not a big fan of socialism. Spamberger, same deal. but they are focused on what is impacting their constituents most. That is their pocketbooks. That is the prices that are of everything right now. They have not, inflation has not really slowed down all that much. It keeps going up. I keep waiting to walk into Publix down here and be able to buy steaks at a reasonable price. But looks like I have chicken now, like chicken for days, chicken for months.
Chicken's pretty expensive too, man. At least up here in Giant Food Store.
Man. But also, the way that particularly Spamburger did it and the way that Mondami did it is they went directly to the people. I very carefully watched Spamburger's acceptance speech. She was very gracious. I don't think she's a particularly hard-hitting politician. I don't think she's a great candidate. But she represented stability. She represented relatability. And she talked about the things that matter to her voters. Mondami's the same thing. They painted this guy as, you know, he's going to put in Sharia law in New York City. We'll see about that.
Communist. An outright communist, even.
A communist Islamist. Like,
even though they don't go together, but they're both bad, so toss the names on there and see what sticks. I think that's what they were.
Yeah. So he's a Marxist following atheist who also wants to incorporate the law of the Sharia law on people, which is based out of the Quran. I must be too slow to get that one. And also I must forget, like, you know, what happened to the Soviets in Afghanistan at the hands of Islamists. But to counter that, to get back to my point here, when he went to a Knicks game, he sat in the rafters. They kept talking about Sharia law. He went to a gay bar, and he's relating with the people. Now, the truth about that guy is he's probably going to end up closer to Obama than anybody else in terms of what his actual politics are. And I would be willing to bet that, he's not really going to match the rhetoric he threw out there. But we'll see. We will really see. Going back to Spamburger, it'll be interesting to see what happens in Virginia. But man, being from there and seeing it flip so hard blue and even at the delegate level, is nothing short of a complete reaction to the absolute chaos. And I hate to put it this way, but the vitriol that's been coming out of the White House in terms of how they categorize anybody who disagrees with them. And if I had one piece of advice for President Trump, it would be to absolutely rethink how he perceives Thomas Massie and Rand Paul. I worked for Rand for a couple of years. I got to work alongside Thomas Massie. They are decent people, and they are hardcore America first. Like, in the sense that they were doing it, they were practically applying, those fundamental tenets of being, for Americans before anything else, way before Trump probably even knew what that was. I don't get to speak to the president, so.
Yeah. Gary, if you could pull that map back up there again. This, to me, was really, really telling because this is every single county in the state of Virginia, all of them from based on the baseline of how the vote went in 2021, went more to the Democrats. And you see some of them were huge, like Fairfax plus 17, which was already quite blue. Frederick County, Loudoun County, that's where I lived there. That's another one with a huge spike, and it was already big. But even the deep blue red ones, as you talked about, they even went more to the left than where they were before. And to me, that is a resounding repudiation of the everything that the Republicans are standing for right now. And I think a large measure of it is exactly what you just said about how Trump treats people.
Right. And I think it goes a step further too. This guy, he came into office with a couple of mandates, right? I voted for him based on my favorite line he's ever said, no more stupid wars.
I voted for him in 2016 on that very thing.
Yeah. Yeah. And figured it would carry into this administration based on how he was talking publicly about our involvement in Ukraine. Now, I didn't believe he was going to be able to end it on day one. I mean, this is a very complicated, very, very, very complicated thing to try and work your way through. But he has basically been Joe Biden all over again on Ukraine. And people see it. We're getting sucked further in. And you can't discount also what's been going on with our support for Israel. I worked for RFK when all of that kicked off. I was his senior defense and foreign policy advisor. And I saw his reaction to it, which caused me to leave the campaign. And won't really get into that unless you want to, probably not the place for it. But, you know, it was very clear at the time that it was not something we should really get involved in. It wasn't our fight, you know, particularly when you start looking at how they were prosecuting it. And, you know, how many tens of billions of dollars have we dumped in there for them to absolutely raise Gaza, just raise it to the ground? And I grew up with some Palestinian friends who are absolutely destroyed by this emotionally. Yeah, their families are gone where they've been for, I don't even know how many generations are gone. And then what really, really upsets me is the number of kids that have been killed. I was an infantryman in Iraq. You served as well. I mean, we're both combat guys. You know, the feeling of somebody unintentionally getting caught in the middle who doesn't deserve it. And then, you know, when that becomes a kid, you know, that's it's beyond horrible. And you're talking about tens of thousands of it, and the American people see it, and there's been no logic applied to it. Then you can get into the economy. I mean, are we any better? No.
And so let me ask you a question along that regard. In light of that soundbite I just put from Mike Johnson, one of the things that just aggravated me beyond description is he has these real condescending statements like, well, of course it's the Democrats' fault and all they have to do. You talk about what people know and what people see. When you see that map, when everybody swung more to the left there, that tells me that they're seeing through that stuff. And they're like, no, it's not just the one. There's people who don't like the Democrats at all. But when they see Johnson talking about like that, or when some of the things that comes out of the White House, they think, well, and I'm telling you this from a firsthand experience from people I just talked to, they say, I voted for the blue side, even though I would never have voted for the blue side because of what's coming out of the red side right now. How do you see that at large?
I think it should be a major alarm bell for the Republicans going into the midterms. Major alarm bell. And, you know, one of the reasons I'm glad Mondami won is I hope it is a wake up call. Because he ran a populist campaign in New York City. He basically took Trump's entire approach, which made him successful, particularly in 2016, and he flipped it to his own purposes. And, you know, there's an element of that in the other two states. You know, and there is a massive reaction from the American population right now, at least, you know, in the present time, where they don't feel like their needs are being met or their voices are being heard, because the things that they want aren't getting done, and the things they were promised are also not getting done. So I'm hoping that this is a major note that Republican strategists can take and actually start applying some America First principles in how they do things. And it starts with ending the shutdown and getting their people back to work. You know, and because we haven't really touched on this yet, but, you know, the secondary and tertiary effects of this, you know, when you start having a whole bunch of people miss their mortgage payments, their car payments, you know, the effect of money not being pumped back into local economies, particularly like where I live off a military base, two things keep the lights on around here. One are the permanently stationed military personnel, and there's a lot of them. They're not getting paid. Along with usually the GS side, which is a large contingent. The other is tourism. But if people don't have money, they don't take vacations. And if people around here aren't working, they're not spending their money. And the small businesses are getting kicked in the gut. And that's before you get to what could happen in January with the ACA. So I'm hoping they're taking notes on all of this and they revisit how they approach everything. But I wouldn't hold my breath.
Yeah, and I'm hoping that any of both parties wake up, because there's got to be some changes here. Because I personally, as I've said many times on our show here, I'm sick and tired of the two parties throwing rocks and mud at each other, oblivious to what's happening down here. Because there's no doubt in my mind that the Democrats could have prevented this from ever getting shut down. The Republicans could have prevented this from ever shut down. Neither side has been willing to, and is not now willing to do the same thing. And now then, because of all this stuff that happened just on Tuesday of this week, it seems even further away than it was before.
I agree with you. And, you know, you'd think theoretically that this would be the absolute perfect time for a third party to emerge. However, the, the two parties in place have such a stranglehold on the financial aspect of, you know, how you get elected, it makes it really difficult. So I don't know, maybe Elon Musk wants to revisit that right now. He was talking about it a few months ago, maybe starting a third party. But you know, that's actually, you know, going back to gerrymandering, that would be the natural, you know, kind of cure for what they're doing, which is, you know, which is very clearly an aggressive and opportunistic way to seize long-term power in various areas, whether it's Gavin Newsom in California, whether it's what Trump's doing in Texas, and then what else spirals off of this, you know, would be the emergence of a third party, which has no to both sides. And that would just require somebody with a strong leadership set and actual vision. You know,
right. And that's why I'm not at all hopeful on Elon Musk, because he has no leader. He just has a lot of cash. But I mean, the last thing anybody's going to like gravitate toward now is another billionaire, right, who just, you know, wants his toys and whatever. So unfortunately, I don't think that's a path right now. But let's take a look at what the two parties, because let's take a look, first of all, at the Democratic Party, because in light of what happened with Mamdani, there's, let's see if I, let me pull this one up here. The Washington Post, if I can get the right one up here, let me make sure it's the right one. I think it's this one, or maybe it's this one. Let me pull it up here. Nope, that's the wrong one. So I had a good shot there. I had a 50-50 chance, and I got the wrong one. But let me go back to the other one here. They're talking about that the outside of New York, the democratic socialism is lost. So the gist of here was this, this is not Mamdani's America. This is, by the way, this is obviously pro-Democrat. Even for its size, New York City politicians always get outsized attention because of its national media's headquarters there. A charismatic socialist won the mayor's race by capitalizing on a wheezing democratic establishment typified by the skeezy, interesting word there, Andrew Cuomo. Can't dispute that. But in practice, most Americans, Democrats included, do not want what Mamdani is peddling. Now, this to me kind of sounds like nothing to see here, folks. So whatever happened Tuesday, blip in the pan, move on. But I think one of the reasons why Mamdani won, and why, and none of the major can, none of the major political figures in the Democratic Party got behind him, and he won without them anyway, and blew out, you know, what had been Cuomo, had been one of their mm-hmm. folks here. Do you see that the Democratic Party at risk of further blowing their opportunities and not paying attention to what the people are saying in New York?
Yeah, I do. And I think that's on both sides of the aisle. You can make a big deal about Mamdani being a democratic socialist or that, that, and the other thing. Really what it comes down to is he was beholden to the interests of his voters, and he let them know that in any number of different ways. He connected with them on an individual basis, you know, and did a fantastic job as a candidate. He is very charismatic. And I think that if the Republicans are going to lift something from that, and I'll get to the different piece of it here in a second. It's exactly that, you know, it's, he is the 2024 kind of squishy liberal socialist version of a 2016 Donald Trump, where he's speaking the language of the people and relating to the people he wants to have vote for him. In terms of, you know, the long-term viability of, say, the Democratic Socialist Party, I wouldn't count them out. You know, they have an incredibly strong ground game, and it comes down to something that impacts both sides of the aisle, right? Is people in my age bracket and younger, and I'm sure in your age bracket too, but particularly in my age bracket and younger, recognize how beholden politicians are to, shall we say, big interests, outside influences. You know, they talk a good game to a point, and then the people who would fund them the rest of the way, the machine, if you will, takes over and they're gone, you know, and people are sick of it. And it's showing up in such a huge way in our day-to-day operations here in this country. And people are sick and tired.
No, see, it's because that seems to be, and I'm glad you mentioned that it's something that both parties need to figure out, mm-hmm. because you had a lot of the Democratic stalwarts like Cuomo and a lot of his supporters, they were bashing Mamdani left and right. You had Trump, bending over backwards to bash him and saying all this stuff and communists and all this. And a lot of the conservative media were just bashing him up one side and down the other as though it was something critical to them. And yet the people that were on the ground in New York seem to just say, I don't care what any of y'all are saying. I'm ignoring all of you. And I'm going to go with, because at least he's talking about helping me. Is this a canary in the coal mine, or is it just something you just was played off one off in New York?
It's a canary in the coal mine. And in a lot of ways, it reflects 2016. Everybody savaged Trump in 2016 for everything, from every angle. And the consensus was, we don't care. Like, the harder you and the establishment and the harder you and the media push, the more we're going to get behind this guy. And that's what happened. So it's, in essence, it appears to be a return to what the people want and what works. We're post COVID. It's been a long time. There's a lot that's happened. And in a lot of ways, people are more economically desperate. They want more than ever us to restrain what we're doing around the world, militarily in particular. Yep. And we keep getting promised leaders, quote unquote, big air quotes on that. I hate that I used leaders. Getting politicians who are out there, saying time and time again, effectively like what we want to hear and not producing any kind of results. And it's led to a tremendous amount of cynicism. And at some point, it's going to come to a head. And I don't know what that looks like. But I really hope that the party leadership on both sides recognizes that and starts catering to the American people before, things potentially get pretty messy.
So let's take a look at the Democrat side here at the leadership level. Sorry, I forgot to quote that one. level. Brett Baer interviewed Hakeem Jeffries. And this to me is about the worst way he could have answered the question that Brett's going to ask. He's going to hold up and show a soundbite of Ocasio-Cortez and about how she's saying, the Democratic leadership blew it with Mamdani and they're going to have to pay attention to that. And then Baer asked him a question. And to me, it's the classic, I'm not going to answer the question that you asked. See if you would agree.
Here's what Congresswoman Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez said about Mayor-elect Mamdani and his race.
He had to not just defeat a Republican. He had to defeat a Republican and the old guard of the Democratic Party at the same time. The Democratic Party cannot last much longer by denying the future, by trying to undercut our young, by trying to undercut a next generation.
Are you part of the old guard or the future that Congresswoman Ocasio-Cortez talks about her and Mayor-elect Mamdani?
In the House, as you know, we have a two-year employment contract. And every 2 years, we have to go back to the voters and make our case as to whether we are continuing to deliver for the American people, the people that we're privileged to represent, in ways that improve their quality of life. That's what Democrats are all about at this moment, House Democrats in particular.
So are you part of the old guard or are you part of the new guard? I worked for 2 years and that's what Democrats are all about. Anyway, did you see? That's what people are sick about in politics.
Mm-hmm.
He had a golden, tell me if you agree. I mean, you've helped run some campaigns. It seems to me that he had a golden opportunity to chart a new course, to say that I'm not the old guard, here's the new guard, something. And instead, he literally didn't answer the question.
Right there with you. I was actually going to say, like, if you hadn't prompted me, that, man, Hakeem, you missed your chance. You missed the boat. You missed the bus. Like, he had a grand opportunity to reconnect with the voter base and actually stand for something. And that squishy freaking response that he gave is exactly what everybody's sick of. And quite frankly, he answered the question without answering the question. Like, he is part of the old guard. And what's worse is he showed on TV that he's scared of bucking the establishment. And I will say one other thing. It's kind of rich for AOC to get up there and talk about defeating the establishment. She was anti-establishment, I think, for about 5 seconds when she came into the House. But, she's a run-of-the-mill big D Dem now.
Which yeah, I've had some of my good D friends who have lamented that very thing on her.
Yeah. I mean, I don't lament it necessarily. It's
you're not, but from the D side, they lament it because they wanted her to be a non traditional Democrat. But that's kind of the, you know, what we see a lot of here. And it's not just on the Democrats. Now I'm going to actually go to this one on purpose that I actually meant to. It's also on the Republican side. So this is written by Jeff Flake, former member of a Republican member of Congress and Senate. He says there's a great GOP migration has begun. And especially after this this disaster that happened on Tuesday, tell me to what extent did you think the GOP is saying, hey, hang on. A lot of stuff that Trump is doing, they recognize what happens. They see that map that happened that we showed you from Virginia. Another one similar that was happened in New Jersey, similar, very similar. And they're like, hang on, we're not heading into 2026. And so now I'd like your kind of views on this, because it seems to me that a lot of Republicans, and maybe John Thune's one of them, who's not wanting to give Trump what he's asking for, which is the nuclear option in the Senate, because there's a lot of Republicans that are also going to have to stand for re-election this coming year. How do you see the Republicans now then? Is Trump losing his grip because following him could cost them their jobs?
So this is a complicated answer. So you have to bear with me for a second. But MAGA principally is not Trump's movement. That's the baseline. He was the guy that they eventually grabbed onto and glommed onto and got to the White House. This goes all the way back to the Tea Party. If not before that, it is a groundswell. It is a bottom up type of American political movement. And what happened to the Tea Party is they hung around the hill long enough and they eventually got absorbed into, you know, the greater Republican Party. The same thing has happened with air quote MAGA. And it's a little bit different than what happened to the Tea Party. But, you know, all you really need to know, I think, at the starting point on this is who was Trump's first campaign visit to this last cycle? Lindsey Graham. Lindsey Graham should be his mortal enemy if he's against stupid wars. And so I think the entire arc of MAGA orthodoxy has gotten pirated a little bit. There we go. Yeah. Lindsey Graham is not about making America great again. We could have an entire show about that if we wanted to. But he has moved off towards neoconservatism. And I think a lot of that is his own political inexperience. He doesn't understand necessarily who the people he has surrounding him who are recommended to him. He is not well read on political ideology. He doesn't understand how Washington works. He never has. That's how he ended up with John Bolton as national security advisor in the last administration. So what MAGA means in terms of the Republican Party is vastly different than what MAGA means to the American voter. Those people haven't changed. But what people in the Republican establishment should understand, I think, right now, and they should be worried that if they're glomming onto the current Trump orthodoxy, which has nothing to do with the principles of limited government, adherence to the Constitution, traditional American governmental values, and that's represented very, very, very clearly in his push to get rid of the filibuster. They should understand that once again, they're way too far in front on their skis, much like, you know, Bush was by the end of his second term. Will they get another candidate who can really represent the true, you know, nature of the movement and what the American people want? I don't know. I don't know who that would be. But that idea is not going away.
So let me ask you from the MAGA universe perspective, not the leadership, when they see Trump doing things which used to be really opposed to them, especially those who, you know, say that they have these certain morals or so, and they see him, you know, giving a, not a protest, I'm sorry, what's the word I'm looking for? They commuted the sentence of this drug dealer that he had last week. Just a terrible guy who benefited his son in a lot of crypto stuff.
Right.
Gave him a pardon. What's his face? The guy from New York, the crazy one, the one that lied all the time. George, I can't remember his name.
Oh yeah, the
Santos, George Santos.
Yep,
right. Just horrible person. I mean, convicted left and up and right, just did terrible things, and he pardons him. I mean, those are things those aren't MAGA values, at least what's often talked about. And then now here we're talking about nearly and almost directly having a regime change war in Venezuela. Mm-hmm. Just blowing up boats left and right, no matter what the Constitution says, what the 1973 war power says, you know, just whatever. I wanted to go and shoot some people in Iran, so I did that too. Those don't seem to be what I think that the MAGA, certainly not what I voted for in 2016. Oh, I didn't vote for him the last two times. I'll just say that. But I did in 2016 for that reason. And one of the reasons I haven't since then. Is that going to play well on the MAGA universe?
No, absolutely not. You know, it gets into the final piece of that, which is, you know, your quote unquote MAGA voters aren't going anywhere except to a different candidate. You know, they have their principles, they have their ideals, and you can run this all the way back, you know, to what the Democrat Party used to contain. It was, you know, your blue collar union workers, farmers, the South, you know, and that party ceased to represent their values and their ideals. They moved, you know, over, you know, a couple of decades to this whole woke ideology. And along the way, their voters bled off and they went over to the Republican side and eventually coalesced around the MAGA movement. And they'll go back again. They'll go somewhere else. You know, and you talk about electoral politics a little bit. You have, you know, you can frame it in three thirds. You have your hardcore Republicans, you have your hardcore Dems, and then you have everybody in the middle who's going to decide your election, and they vote based on their principles and their pocketbooks. And they'll go to the candidate that best represents that. And that's what the Republicans are taking for granted right now in a really, really big way. You know, by executing the different kinds of policies they're executing, which are, you know, nonsensical, but a direct continuation of the neoconservatives who were in power for a long time, but B, the transactional nature of this administration. And you can pull up any number of different things where, you know, we put a tariff on a country, they would agree to do something for, say, a Trump kid or a golf course, say in Vietnam. And then the tariffs get released and they get left, you know, they're gone. Any number of those would be massive scandals before, but they're not now. But people do pick up on it. And if it was benefiting the individual American, you know, it might be a different tune, but it's not, you know, and it culminated.
So how's it working with Trump, who routinely says, my approval numbers are the best they've ever been. Clearly they're not. The price of groceries is coming down. Clearly it's not. Inflation is getting better. It's not, you know, and he keeps saying things that people, I mean, you mentioned going to Publix. I mentioned the other day I went to Giant. I wanted to get some chicken thighs, which we really like a lot. And it was like $17. And I'm like, what in the world is going on? I don't care what President Trump says. When I go to the grocery store, I see what the cost is. Mm-hmm. How much longer can Trump do stuff like have this, you know, this big party that he just had, you know, last week, this elaborate, lush, you know, kind of risque party, having this, you know, tearing up part of the White House and having this big ballroom, which doesn't benefit any American. It seems to me that he's like taking everybody for granted. Can he keep doing that?
He can't. He absolutely can't. If they want to have a snowball's chance in hell, you know, during the midterms, they need to make a hard pivot now. They need to figure out how to end the shutdown in a way where they save face. You know, and I think the idea behind it was that they were going to get the Dems to break, continue to fund the government, and then figure the subsidies out at some point. And, you know, Trump get to be the hero, just like he wanted to win the Nobel Peace Prize. It didn't happen. It's not going to happen. And they need to get back in touch with what brought them to the White House, what brought all of these legislators to DC real fast, or none of them are going to have a job in a year or so. And Trump will be a lame duck.
So and we only have a few minutes left here. What's going to happen? How long is this shutdown going to go? And which side do you think is going to buckle? Somebody's going to have to buckle.
I don't think the Dems buckle. I really don't. They're fueled up by their win this week. And then also at the same time, you know, they're coming up against the expiration of these subsidies, that $30 billion, which is a drop in the bucket for the national budget, if you want to call it a budget. And they have, they're somewhat righteous in what their cause is. They are, you know, in their eyes, I don't necessarily agree with this, but in their eyes, they are protecting the American people. They're protecting this middle, this middle third who depend on that. And if those subsidies aren't passed and the premiums jump, then all those voters are going to hold the president to account. And then the rest of us are going to pay with our own healthcare premiums. You know, it's a potential disaster, a big time disaster, politically, and also financially for us, you know, trying to keep kids healthy and all that. But,
kind of important. Yeah, well, listen, I really appreciate it. We're out of time here, but I really, really appreciate it. Look forward to having you back again real soon, because this is not going anywhere. And I'm sure there's going to be a lot of events that we're going to need some expertise on coming up real soon. So really appreciate you. Thanks a lot.
Hey, thank you so much for having me. Dan, it's good seeing you again.
You too. And I appreciate you guys. And we are going to stay on top of this for you, folks. Remember, we are unintimidated and uncompromised. And I don't care what party anybody's doing anything. We are all about the truth and integrity for the American people. And we're going to continue to do that for you. No matter how it comes out, we're on your side. Thanks, folks. And we'll see you on the next episode of Daniel Davis Deep Dive.